They change cultures. They're heat seekers. They run at adversity and embrace change. These are the Room Tilters.
Somebody who can change the temperature in a room when they walk in. I mean, that's metaphorical for somebody who can influence those around them and make such an impact quickly, emphatically, and long-lasting, whether it be an organization, a team, a relationship, whatever it might be.
This is the Room Tilters podcast, presented by Limitless Minds. Co-hosts DJ Eitzen and Harry Wilson, founders of peak performance and leadership consulting company, Limitless Minds, explore how the best and brightest change the temperature in a room. From sports, the military, entertainment and media, clinical psychologists to CEOs, this podcast will navigate what it takes to think big and go far. And now,
DJ and Harry. Tiffany Nabors, welcome to the Room Tilters podcast. Tiffany, how's it going this morning?
Good, DJ. Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today.
Yeah, we're really excited. Harry couldn't be on today, but I'm getting the opportunity to talk to you. I know you built companies, you're an author, a mom, a businesswoman, a wife. You're doing all these things, juggling all these things. So we're excited to kind of get a sneak peek behind the curtain of Tiffany Nabors. So just to get the listeners, you know, acclimated to you, tell us a little bit about your background, your family, where you're from, all that kind of stuff.
I'm from Richmond, Virginia. I am a proud Richmonder. I spent the first 21 years of my life in Richmond. And then I went to school in Petersburg, Virginia.
Okay.
And from there, my mom relocated after spending all of her life in Richmond as well to Northern Virginia. And it came at a time where I graduated from college. And so I followed her there, kicking and screaming. But it turned out to be the best thing ever. And I've been here since. But I started my career post-college in the clinical healthcare space, working as a substance abuse counselor with inner city heroin addicts. And I'm not apologetic about it. My mom got me the job.
Right.
I was a psych major with no graduate degree. And so I'm like, Mom, I need a job and I need a real job. And so she used her network and got me a position. I actually started off in the child care area, and I was allowed to kind of test myself in the counseling area, and they found a spot for me.
Mm-hmm.
And in that position, it was a research project, actually, with this specific population. So it's kind of like a population health study on how to treat heroin addiction. And it was through the American University at the time. And it was in Northeast D.C., had a caseload of about 50. We did not have electronic healthcare records at that time. So literally, I handled caseloads by paper, and we would literally have audits and raids by the DEA, if you will, because it was a methadone clinic, and that was a controlled substance. And so you literally had these strict compliance, you know, rules. And here I am, 23 years old, managing people who honestly have been doing drugs longer than I have been alive.
Wow.
And I had never, ever, ever, and still to this day, done any drug. And so they literally, in the group counseling session, they're like, how is this person going to tell us anything about getting clean? And I was just, you know, supported by a team of much more senior people who did have experience, not only in counseling, but in sobriety. And so I was the only person at that point who had no experience whatsoever, even in that situation. So those guys embraced me, and, you know, they were all basically self-help people, right? Okay. So self-improvement junkies. And of course, being a psychology major, I was a self-improvement junkie as well. And they just brought me in, and they helped me with my story. They told the guys, they told all of my patients that she's going to tell you how to live life and deal with adversity without drugs.
Nice. Right?
And so they gave me my story, and I lived up to that. I eventually was promoted to counseling, but that was challenging because where at one point I was being mentored and helped by all of these teammates of mine, I eventually became their supervisor.
Yep.
Which was, you know, hard because I had the least amount of experience, you know, at the life level, right? Yep. And then at the counseling level, they had a lot more experience. It was the hardest job. I heard and lived and experienced stories that were mind-boggling. But it opened me up to something that I never knew that I would eventually find myself needing to relate to 20 years later. And that is, I became health IT sales executive, or sales executive focused on health IT. I started at Oracle, got into sales, and I eventually just kind of had progressive sales growth experiences. And I worked for systems integrators, you know, doing large deal sizes. And eventually I ended up at United Healthcare Optum. That was my last company, and I managed their largest payer.
I don't think your first jobs are even on your LinkedIn, are they?
I think my LinkedIn is only my sales experience.
Sales experience, yeah. So like when we saw that and we looked and saw that you had that background, it's amazing, because just being in the pharmaceutical industry and going in and out of doctor's offices for a long period of time, we obviously worked with physicians that, you know, were treating all different types of patients, including people that were suffering from addiction. And so we got to hear about that adversity. We got to see that adversity. How do you think that prepared you for the business world and what you got into at Optum, those early experiences? Tell us a little bit about that.
So I think a lot of things in that role prepared me. One was being able to accept a role that I wasn't prepared for, and understanding how to do it scared. Right. I don't know that I knew I was scared at the time, because when you're 23, you kind of feel entitled to that next promotion. So you kind of think that's the way it's supposed to happen.
Right.
So I didn't realize what a responsibility it was. In hindsight, I understand now that I've had some management experience and life experience, I understand the drivers behind that decision a little differently.
Yeah.
But I think being able to know when you need to lead, even when it's not understood by others around you, and being comfortable with that. So that prepared me for almost every role that I had after that, because for whatever reason, every job that I had, I was always the youngest one. I remember one day I was working for an Army colonel in a sales job. So in the federal government space, a lot of times they will have former military or government professionals transition to the commercial world, and they help drive business operations and sales roles. And my boss happened to be a retired Army colonel. And one day we were in what they call a gate review, which is like a pipeline meeting. He said something to me. I basically got upset and walked out of a meeting just to regroup.
Right.
He let me have it. Okay. And he says, you don't ever walk out of a meeting, right? And basically that was the only time in my career that I was maybe intimidated by something or someone. And I think it was a maturity issue, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't like that was the norm, but it was one of those things where being a leader at a young age and having an account and responsibilities, because the role that I had was always one where it's like multi-million dollar deal. An average deal size is 30 million, right? Because that's just the nature of the government contracting space. And so I think that just doing things at a younger age and having to be being surrounded by people that are much older than you and much more tenured than you, and having to basically understand how to influence and gain respect with different age or populations was a big challenge, right?
Yeah, no doubt.
But they all became mentors, and it just worked itself out. I mean, I think I did my first sales job in the government space calling on C-level at 26.
Wow.
But I didn't know. You know, it's all about you don't know what you don't know.
That's right. No, that's good. So working for a company like Optum and, you know, having the career path that you have, most people that are in the corporate world would love to have a career path like you've had. I mean, you've been extremely successful. So how do you do that and then jump into Winasium? Tell me about what that looked like, and then what you guys are doing there as the founder and CEO, pretty much everything, right, at Winasium, right?
You know, it's funny because I did not want to go to Optum, but I made a decision to go to graduate school in 2012 for business to get my MBA. Mm-hmm. So that was my second stint in graduate school. And I did that because all of my life I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur, but I wasn't comfortable doing that. I felt like I had to do that safe job, that safe career, the titles and the corporate roles.
Right.
Because, I don't know, just was the thing that people did. And I just didn't have that courage that a lot of people have today and that I have today to trust the vision, to trust that intuition, to trust the dreams, right?
Yeah.
And so I went to Optum because one, it's basically the Harvard, in my opinion, of the healthcare space, right? It's owned by the largest payer in our country. And so there was so much learning there. There are huge M&A, lots of M&A activity, which was an interest of mine. And I wanted to work for someone who had recruited me. And so it was one of those things where I said, I know I want to start my own business, but I need to do this. This is that last job that I want to have. So I always knew I wanted to stop, you know, around the 40-ish age and then start that second career, much like what military people do. They do about 20 years and then they retire and have that second
career. That's true. Yeah. That's a good analogy. Yeah.
Yeah. And I supported Defense Health for most of my career before going to the civilian health side. So, you know, that was kind of my model and what I knew. But I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. My great uncle used to come around the family a lot, and he was always just this jovial, happy person. And he owned hotels in Richmond back during the days of segregation.
Okay.
And the stories that they told us, he had restaurants and a hotel and a motel. And I always remember the enthusiasm, the happiness. He was the only person besides another uncle who owned a farm and a convenience store and all of these other businesses. They were the only people around me that seemed just jovial and happy about work.
Right.
I don't know why.
Right.
And it stuck with me, you know, and I don't know what it was about the things that I observed with them. So I always said I wanted to own my own business. And my father is an engineer and he had his own business on the side as well. I was just drawn to that part of the business. So I always knew that I wanted to do this. And so in 2004, I kind of put my foot in the water and I launched this business called Shopology.
Okay.
And at that time it was combining my love of fashion and the IT world that I was in. I created basically a version of Yelp. Right. So it was basically like a online directory for independent boutiques. These are stores that are hard to find because they're basically mom and pop stores. They're amazing, but there was no advertising. And so I did that alongside my job. My Army colonel boss actually was the one who gave me permission to do this side gig.
Yeah.
And when I did that, I was written up in the Washington. I did a boot camp.
Yep.
And I was written up, they wrote up our boot camp and story about, you know, helping women, female entrepreneurs, and they featured my business idea. At that time, I didn't realize that was a big deal, as naive as it sounds, because my mindset was such that I was embarrassed that people would think that I wasn't focused on my career.
Okay.
And so I kind of, you know, of course it was a little bit you did have the web 2.0 kind of emerging, but for the most part, it wasn't anything that was completely, you know, out there.
Right.
But I missed that opportunity because of, in my opinion, a lack of courage and a lack of trust and vision.
Okay.
And so I kind of sat on it. I played with it. But when I went to graduate school and, you know, I really immersed myself in studying a lot of the ventures, specifically that one, and just kind of relaunching that, I realized that it had turned into an $80 billion industry.
Wow.
What I uncovered in 2004 was actually the beginning of fashion technology. And what happened is fashion was in New York and finance was in New York. So those two industries kind of came together and a lot of fashion ventures were funded. Wow. And it just became this whole industry after that. Mm-hmm. And so that experience, that reality of being in grad school and you know, knowing that I was there to kind of relaunch the business and learn and just kind of define this way ahead was a turning point for me.
Okay, good.
And so I said, I will never again sit on a business idea. That's what Winnasium became about, right? It was, I'm going to go out on my own. I'm not going to start Shopology again right now. I'm going to leverage the network I have. address some of the pains in the market around the sales function, you know, kind of deliver some of the experience that I have differently. I didn't want to do my old job on a contract basis. So what I did was I really heard a lot of pains in the market around the sales function. A lot of business owners really didn't understand how to sell, how to motivate, how to manage, and how to select sales talent. And that's what I decided to do. And then a lot of sales reps, they struggled with how to present their performance or how to achieve high performance. So I really just kind of focused on that aspect of the sales consulting practice, but in a niche space, which is health. Because I think in the health space, you really need to understand the voice of the customer. And we have a very dynamic healthcare market right now. As you know, it's a lot of transformation, a lot of mergers and acquisitions. And so a lot of the needs of the customer need to be captured. And then I think as a salesperson, you want to be empowered by that. So I focus specifically on helping sales reps succeed in the business of health.
That's awesome. What have you learned? You know, what's the big key thing that you've learned in launching this business over the last couple of years?
It's hard. I didn't expect it easy.
Right.
But it's lonely, right? Uh-huh. Because I don't have business partners by design. I kind of feel like I need to learn things on my own. And then I want to build from there. It's lonely and it's hard, but I love it. Like there's nothing. I get up every morning and I work so that I never have to have another job again.
Right. Right.
But I love the ability to actually, every day I get a new challenge and I get to do and build what I want to build. And it's based on what I see as kind of market needs in real time. Mm-hmm. You know, back in 2004, we built business plans. Today, we don't do that anymore. We kind of, you know, you look at the lean startup market method, and you and I have talked about just, you know, approaches to starting out. And it's really about letting the market dictate to you what you need, which is kind of how I started, right? It's everyone's saying that they don't know how, you know, there's this revolving door of salespeople, they can't get them to perform, and there's this whole pain.
Right.
How do we address that, right? And so that's what my reality is right now.
And like you said, you're doing it on your own, which is a testament to the, you know, your skill set that you're able to do so many different things. But like you said, I'm sure it can get lonely when you're really leaning on yourself. Who do you draw strength from then? And where do you draw your strength from?
So I'll tell you, as lonely as it is, I do have a fraternity sorority around me in terms of my health IT community, because you know, having been in the business for 26 years, I kind of grew up with a small niche group of people.
Right.
And that's who I draw upon. So we have like strong networking events. I still do everything in the same community where I used to work, except I'm a consultant now or a business owner. So in my day-to-day interactions, it's my clients and my candidates and those different dynamics, but I still have that whole base of my peers.
Well, that's great. It's again, a testament to the relationships that you've been able to build over the last several years. So family, tell me a little bit about family. Like, so we, Harry and I, between the two of us, so my wife and I have five kids, Harry's got three girls, right? So there's eight kids running around the room tilters, but tell us about a little bit about your family and dynamics and again, how you manage and juggle that.
So one of the drivers I didn't mention before is my family, right? So I wanted to have better work-life integration. One of the things that when I got my first vice president job in 2008, my manager was a female. Her name was Anne. And she said, when I accepted the job, she goes, I know you have small children, and I just want to make sure you understand that it's important not to work your way through your children's upbringing.
Right.
And it was a powerful statement at the time. And I couldn't process it because my kid was like two, right? And I'm still thinking that I can conquer the world, because when you have one kid, like you know, it's, you're kind of thinking that it's a little easier, right?
That's right. That's right.
And then what happened was she ended up transitioning out of the company. Mm-hmm. And I watched how hard she had worked. And I watched, you know, and learned over time a lot of the sacrifices that she had made in her career to devote herself to her company and her job at the expense of maybe spending more time, you know, balancing the family piece. And it was different, you know, in the years prior to me getting in the business, the times that she kind of grew up in. I remember that. I want to create a company where I can still balance things a lot more. And so I have two kids. I have a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old, and I'm married. My husband's also self-employed. He's an attorney, and basically took a risk. We took a risk and we juggled, but he's very supportive. That's and awesome. So, you know, without him, I could not and would not be able to do this. And, you know, it was a big risk, but it was something that I communicated for many years. So it was totally not unexpected.
With the two kids, and you, boys or girls?
One of each.
Your 9-year-old's the girl, right?
Yeah.
Is that correct? And so, yeah. Which leads me to the question around this book that you just wrote, The Unicorn Dreamer.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to hear about that. Tell us about the genesis of that and how that came about and then where you're at with it right now.
Yeah, so that was totally unexpected. It came to me as a vision in the middle of the night, literally. And I always wake up at 3 a.m. with ideas, right? That's been happening forever. For some reason, when I got this story that just came to me, I wrote it down. And then when I woke up, I got visions of visuals. And then it just, every day it became a waking obsession. And so for 6 months, I contracted out fashion illustrators to create the book and to bring the vision to life. I didn't know what was going to come of it, but as it unfolded, it became more and more clear. And I feel like I was being rewarded because nothing has gone this smoothly in anything that I've probably undertaken. But I did this because I wanted to be obedient to an idea or a vision instead of sitting on it. And I feel like I was rewarded for it. I was basically rewarded for, you know, basically trusting this vision and seeing it through.
Yeah.
Because everywhere that I've introduced the book, it has had an impact on a young girl that I didn't expect it to have. And it's been kind of a little life-changing for me in a short amount of time. And it's really changed my perspective on what matters and where I plan to take things with my business. I definitely feel like it's, you know, a story that I have sat on. It really tells my story, right? About being courageous as an entrepreneur. For many years, I think I was led to believe that a lot of the ideas that I had were just ideas. But in actuality, a lot of visions are from places higher than us.
Yep.
And so a big part of this book is about me kind of outing myself, right, as a dreamer and as a person who has many ideas and being unapologetic about it and hopefully inspiring other creative people to embrace their creative thinking, however it unfolds. For me, I happen to think and create in terms of ideas. And so I capture those as domains, branded domains, and I invest in those. And I believe that some of those ideas are for me to execute, and many of them are for me to give away.
I love how you have this like bias for action, especially now as you're starting to put everything in context. And if we see a lot of the top performers at the companies that we visit, a lot of the top athletes that we're able to, you know, work with and be around, have this bias for action. They see something and then they just go do it. And so I'm really glad that you shared that with our audience because it's actually one of Amazon's core principles. So they instill that into their employees. The other thing is that I'm thinking about as you're talking about, you know, your journey here is that somebody like you had the ability to do this a long time ago, right? You had the ability to be able to run a business probably in your 20s or, you know, early 30s or whatever it is. Do you have any regrets like that you waited too long or, you know, so tell us a little bit about that.
That's what's driving me behind this book about everything. It's the short answer is yes.
Okay.
Right. But I won't call them regrets. So I will tell you, when we talk about adversity, as complicated as maybe life can be, I feel like the hardest thing for me in starting a business was having a network and a whole circle of peers. Because when you're 20 and you start a business, no one really knows you and anything you do is like, right? But when you're 40 something and you start a business and you leave at the peak of your career, people are looking at you like, what the heck are you doing? And so there are several people in my industry in a similar stage that are out there doing consulting, but it's a different dynamic, right? It's right. consulting until they get another job. Uh-huh. And it's doing something safe. It's doing your old kind of functions in a contract basis. Mm-hmm. What I'm doing is a little different and it's a little out there, right? And so that's in a politically sensitive, conservative industry like the federal government space. Mm-hmm. It's a little wacky, right? And so, but my pain around having set on so many ideas exceeds any sort of fear of being vulnerable.
Yeah.
I felt like when I became faithful, because that's what this is, one of my clients calls it a faith walk. And I felt like when I became faithful, I began to attract faith-filled people. And one of the people that is, you know, an example of that said to me, who is your audience? And I knew she wasn't talking about marketing. And I paused and she says, your audience, you have an audience of one, right? Because we were talking about being vulnerable, right? And what it's like to be vulnerable and to kind of feel a little cuckoo, right? About doing things that others don't understand. Uh-huh. And I'm sure that when you went out on your own, you know, you had maybe a similar dynamic where it's like, why would you leave a safe job when you have a family of five and you are the breadwinner, right? And so it's one of those things where it's like, okay, but there's something telling me that I need to do this. So yes, I do have regrets, but I am coming to get everything I left behind.
Again, I asked that question because one of the things I think about as you're talking about your experience is that if I were to have gone out in my 20s, to your point, like, do you have the trust with people? Do you have the network of people, like you mentioned? Do you have the experience? So all these things that we can look back and be like, yeah, I should have went out when I was 30 or 28 or whatever it is. Yeah. But you go out and you don't have nearly the experience that you have when you're 40 or whatever age you jump out at. I don't know if I would call it regret. I just question, you know, kind of like you're doing is like saying, should I have? But, I'm glad I did it now. I know that. And I think to your point, it was, for me, it was also a walk. I had to look at myself and say, am I putting too much faith in myself and not putting enough faith into my God and really kind of leaning in on my faith and saying, you know what, I've always been taken care of. It's funny because my wife said to me before I jumped out for my company, she asked me one question. She says, has God ever not provided? And when she asked me that, it was very rhetorical. You know, she wasn't really expecting an answer from me. But when she asked me that, I think it was the next day or two, I put in my resume. Wow. I try not to regret too, but it's hard sometimes to look back and you're like, maybe I should have jumped out.
I know, but everything works out and it happens when it's supposed to happen, right?
So, that's right. You
know, that's one of those reasons why I kind of say everything happens when it's supposed to happen.
You're obviously a room tilter. I think the listeners can hear that when we look at room tilters and you've been able to listen to some of the podcasts that we have. Somebody, when they walk in the room, the temperature changes. People are drawn to them. You know, they have this unique ability to be able to influence the folks around them. And so in your words, what do you think a room tilter is like? And tell me about maybe one or two people that you've experienced that have been able to tilt a room.
So that's an interesting question. And I definitely think those folks are unforgettable, right? So my husband would be one of those people.
That's
right?
Cool.
He's a litigator. So he's basically a misguided actor. But it's more than act, right? It's a bold enthusiasm that he has and a joy that radiates, right? And so that enthusiasm kind of creates confidence, right? And trust and engagement. It's a speaking piece, but it's also a feeling of authenticity. So you radiate these things, right, that kind of lead and capture, but it's not just the positivity of it. It is the, I think it's a boldness. It's a strength that people can feel. And he commands the room. I also feel like I had a chance to interview John Gordon in one of my early podcasts. And when I interviewed him, I got this, and granted, he's a professional speaker, but I got this energy from him and I'll never forget it. And it was a very commanding thing that was, it was enthusiasm and it was joy, but it was also an intensity, mm-hmm. but it was not an intimidating intensity. It was an engaging intensity. And so I feel like when, you know, when he spoke, he drove that room, right? And I think that those individuals have that sense of presence, that authenticity and that enthusiasm, but it's a bold enthusiasm. It's not just a lighthearted, bubbly kind of thing. Yeah.
Honestly, that is one of the best examples or definitions of a room tilter that I've heard in a while. You know, you talk about joy in being engaging, authenticity. These are things that, like, as I'm listening to people explain room tilting and room tilters, they'll bring out certain things like, but like to be able to kind of summarize it the way you did is really powerful. I think that authenticity piece is so important, especially now where everybody is so consumed on their phone and there's this lack of personal kind of interaction. And so like when you do get time with somebody one-on-one, you can tell very quickly whether or not they're plugged in, you know, to the conversation, to what's going on in the room, because there's so many distractions. And so I think that authenticity piece is huge. And I agree with you. I think that does tilt a room, and the people that we've had on, there's a high level of authenticity with our conversations or the interactions that I've had with them. So thank you for that. What is one area as a room tilter yourself that you want to grow in, that you're trying to improve?
I think it's about being action oriented without hesitating, right? Okay. And I guess that's, in other words, acting immediately on things that are intuitive and logical, and then just trust the things that I know to be right.
As we kind of wrap up here, and we're going to get into some rapid fire questions, which will never make anybody do rapidly, but what is the one thing that you would like the listeners to take with them? What's the call to action?
You know, if there's one thing that I want everyone to do, it's just to be vulnerable, not be afraid to trust the path that is being shown to you, even when you're afraid or when it doesn't make sense. There is a lot of reward, because we're all here to kind of share our gifts, right? We're given gifts, we're given talents. And a lot of times we sit on them. I've seen a lot of creative people in the sales profession, and you become amazed at the talents that they have. And you wonder, like, why are you not using these talents differently? Why are you sitting on or stuffing or hiding in these safe places? In the beginning of my book, I kind of say the book is dedicated to all of the creatives living in the shadows of safe. That's kind of what I would leave with the audience, is trust yourself and don't be afraid to be vulnerable.
That's so great. And trust is so important. We talk about this all the time with leaders as we go into these organizations. Like, you can't really have a firm foundation of a relationship without trust. You know, I think that, you know, if you're building a business, you have to have trust. If you're building a family, you have to have trust. So I love that you bring that up as a call to action, whether it's trusting yourself or trusting those around you, or getting people to buy in and trust what, you know, the vision that you're casting as a leader. So it's really awesome. All right. Rapid fire questions. You ready?
Goodness. All right. Here we go.
One place you'd like to travel for a week with no kids?
I guess Turks and Caicos.
Okay. All right. Outside of work, what are you best at?
I have to say being a mom. Like, I love it. It's one of the greatest joys of my life. Like, I wish I could say it was like something else, but it's being a mom.
That's really cool. That's awesome. All right. In your next life, you will be a
teacher.
Nice. We're teaching now. What are you talking about? That's good. Favorite music group and or artist, dead or alive?
I have two. I like Michael Jackson. I was a junkie. I took my sixth grade picture in a Michael Jackson shirt, and I hope it's never found.
I met Michael Jackson back in the day. So that's a different story.
And then, of course, Hall & Oates.
I love Hall & Oates.
You
that's
do?
Cool. Yes. Yeah. Yes, that's awesome. All right. And what book would you recommend?
John Maxwell, Intentional Living.
He's awesome. He's from Ohio, too.
Oh, yeah, really?
There's a lot of Harry always gets on me, because no matter where we go, there's always somebody from Ohio. I think 1 out of 6 presidents are from the great state of Ohio, which so I don't know if we brag on that or not nowadays, but I digress. A lot of awesome stuff going on in Ohio. Well, it was such a pleasure having you on. I know that you're extremely busy and for giving us time. This means a lot to us. We got to get you to meet, because you know Harry's from Richmond, right?
I know. Yeah, I've never met him, so I would love
Harry
to
and
meet
you. Russ are both from Richmond. Actually, that's where he's headed today. So we're really happy to have you on and hope to get you back soon. So
I appreciate it. I appreciate it a lot, DJ. I've enjoyed talking with you as always. And I appreciate this opportunity.
You've been listening to the Room Tilters podcast, hosted by DJ Eitzen and Harry Wilson, presented by Limitless Minds.